Hi everyone, can you guys hear me? Okay, thanks for coming. I'm Marina Chow, I'm a curatorial assistant in the Department of Photography, and I worked on the exhibition, The Original Copy, Photography of Sculpture, 1839 to today. I will, sorry, I know that I'm kind of, no problem. Let me know if at any point I get a little quiet, and I'll try to turn up the volume a little bit. Just before we start, if I could ask you guys to silence any cellular devices and then hold questions until the end as I go through the show. So just as an introduction, The Original Copy, Photography of Sculpture, 1839 to Today, presents a critical examination of how photography and sculpture have intersected since the inception of the younger medium. Since its invention by Daguerre in 1839, photography has been used by artists to capture images of sculptures. Artists have used it as a tool with which to both analyze sculptural form and to generate creative redefinitions of the medium of sculpture itself. This exhibition brings together nearly 300 works, dating from 1839 to 2009, by over 100 artists to examine how photography can both show us sculpture and also challenge the ways in which we understand what it is. And just as a side note, it is about half and half MoMA collection and then loans from domestic and international institutions and private collections. So the exhibition is organized non-chronologically in 10 conceptual modules, which will go through one by one, stopping to look at specific pictures in each section. So if this exhibition is in part an exploration of new ways in which to see sculpture through the camera's lens, we would do well to start with André Malraux, who you see here, a French novelist and politician who famously did just that. So Malraux would later serve as France's first minister of culture from 1959 to 69, and he praised photography as a way to archive, exhibit, and disseminate images of works of art. So in his 1947 book, Museum Without Walls, Malraux posited that art history, and in particular the history of sculpture, had become the history of that could be photographed. So as an art history student, you're learning about works of art and sculpture through photographs of it, slides, and now digital images. In 1954, Malraux then published a two-volume picture book, The Imaginary Museum of World Sculpture, which you see him here organizing the many, many reproductions in sequence. So he organized 700 photographs of sculpture in a non-chronological sequence, making unexpected juxtapositions that came out of his free association of form and style and close-ups and views of the back of sculptures. So that sort of sets a framework for what this exhibition is looking at. So as you might guess from the exhibition's title, the earliest work in the show is 1839, the year that Daguerre officially announced his invention to an eager group of spectators, August 19th, 1839, at a joint meeting of the Academy of Sciences and the Academy of Beaux-Arts. And accounts of the announcement say that, you know, there was a really large crowd of spectators overflowing into the garden of the building. Though Daguerre had been experimenting with his process of chemically fixing a latent image onto a glass plate since the mid-1820s, the date of this official presentation in 1839 is taken to be the year of photography's invention. Here we see a daguerreotype by Fortier, and this kind of sculptural still life was really a popular early subject for photography. And the appeal of the sculptural still life for these early practitioners was twofold. First, the long exposure time meant that sculpture provided a perfect subject, perfectly still, easy to light, easy to manipulate. And then second, the invention of photography coincided with an increased interest in Europe in the 19th century in museums and in collecting and preservation and exhibiting historical material. So in this still life, you can see a composition that layers various elements, sculptural models, cloths here and here, printed reproductions, in a way that revels in the photograph's ability to render true dimensionality and volume and to capture shadows and contours with great detail. Fortier's juxtaposition of works from different time periods and of different styles is also typical of the still lifes of the time. You can see models of Roman and Greek sculpture, reproductions of Renaissance painting. It's hard to see here, but perhaps this slide back here, there are reproductions, and then here, of Renaissance paintings. And replicas of ancient vessels right here. So you can see how this far predates, but also resonates with Marot's idea that through photography, you can discover new connections between works that are otherwise separated by time and geography and create something new through these visual arrangements. This is a work by Lorraine O'Grady from her series Miscegenated Family Album, which is a 16-part work in which O'Grady pairs a photograph from her own family album with a photograph of famous ancient Egyptian statuary that she culls from art history textbooks. So the pairings bring out uncanny formal relationships between the two pictures, between the two subjects, but also draws on parallels in the personal histories of both subjects. This is a very personal project of hers. So here you see a photograph of Lorraine herself on the left. She identified herself as her sister's sister, Devonia's sister. And on the right you see Queen Nefertiti's sister. So Lorraine and Devonia were estranged for years, and just weeks after they reunited, Devonia tragically died from complications of an illegal abortion. And Nefertiti, in the story of Nefertiti, she left her children and sister behind when she died at the age of 38 after 6 years of banishment. So the miscegenation from the series title refers to genetic and cultural hybridity, which is the literal definition of the word. The artist is of West Indian descent and was born and raised in Boston. And then also research has suggested that ancient Egyptians are of mixed heritage, mixed blood. And but it also talks about the unexpected cross-pollination of the personal histories between her family members and these historical figures. So in the second half of the 19th century in Europe, there was a rapidly growing interest in documenting the world through photographs. It was fed in turn by colonial expansion, the European fascination with the exotic, growth and the growth of tourism. So many photographers traveled to make photographic surveys of distant countries. William James Stillman went to Greece, Maxime Ducamp, whose picture you see here, and J.B. Green went to Egypt, and Felice Beato to China and India. This is a photograph by Ducamp, who traveled through Egypt and Syria from 49 to 51, and later published an album of 125 photographs from his survey. Here he shows a close-up of a monumental sculptural relief of Ramses II, and it's buried past its neck in sand here. Now it's fully excavated, and you can see the entire thing. But Ducamp's photograph documents ancient sculptural and architectural ruins, but it also belies a colonialist agenda. So the photographic archives that all of these traveling European photographers were making were a way to stake a claim to possess these other places that they were traveling to. These photographs were taken and then brought back and consumed by those privileged enough to have access to something like a limited edition photo album. Ducamp also, he very purposefully kept the local populations out of his photographs, so we know from accounts that in this vicinity of this temple there were villages, but he kept it devoid of people entirely except the man you see at the top there. So in this way, the Egypt he brought back to France was pristine and untouched, and he became a kind of conqueror in that way. So atop the headdress, you'll see a Nubian sailor that Ducamp used as his assistant, and he would put him in the pictures to provide scale. So this section is the first of four monographic focuses in the exhibition, where the work of a single artist, Eugène Acce, Auguste Rodin, Constantin Brancusi, and Marcel Duchamp, is examined in greater depth. So we'll start with Eugène Acce. So during the first quarter of the 20th century, Eugène Acce took photographs, hundreds of photographs of sculptures in and around Paris and the surrounding parks and gardens, especially at Versailles, Saint-Cloud, and Sceaux. Acce began taking photographs as a service, so to scholars who studied the old city and to artists and architects who needed images as source material or as memory aids for their work. He wasn't known as a photographer, wasn't well known during his time, but it was only later, after his death in 1927, Berenice Abbott, who was a student of Man Ray's, photographer, great photographer in her own right, was a great supporter of his work and bought all of the existing negatives and prints and kept them safe until in 1969 this museum acquired them. So Etche's body of work amounts to over 8,500 pictures taken at the end of the 20th century when Paris was undergoing a modern transformation at the hands of Napoleon III and Baron Haussmann. Etche's photographs amount to a visual archive of Paris at the time, preserving the treasures of the old city. So in fact, Etche had friends who were working for a conservation group who would routinely tell him which chateaus, which buildings, which sites were marked for demolition so he could go out and photograph them. These are two details of vases in Versailles. You can see the graffiti. This is from 1906 graffiti. This is a selection from a series of 24 pictures Etche took of allegorical statues in Versailles. So the statues were designed by Charles Le Brun, commissioned in 1674, and draw from the figures in a very influential emblem book of 1593, Iconologia, that provided visual and figural representations of abstract and complex notions. So illustrations of vice and virtue as figures. There are figures of humors as well. So we have the phlegmatic, we have melancholy, and there are representations of Europe and winter. And their marble form is a stark white against the black background of the foliage behind them. And in these photographs by Etche, these figures emerge as actors in a drama, which points to his own interest in acting. Etche was actually, he studied acting and he played with a traveling troupe that went around the suburbs of Paris. Etche was also interested in how the camera could capture detail in a sculpture, like you saw in the vase images, and in how photography could isolate a sculpture and multiply its dramatic potential tenfold, those images that we just looked at of the allegorical figures. And in this pair of photographs from the gardens at Sceaux, you can see his interest in how the camera can also register temporality. So the photographs are taken of the exact same sculpture, the same site, two different times, two different seasons, and highlights how different the sculpture's impact is with and without the backdrop of the trees. So here we're extending sort of the sculpture's presence. It's apart from being one stationary object, very permanent, it becomes sort of through these two pictures, this pendant pair here, an extension of it through time. And again, you can see the same sort of thing at work here, taken in these pictures around the reflecting pool in Saint-Cloud. And so it's sort of both, the temporality is sort of both captured in the movement around the pool, taking the pictures in a sort of time-lapse cinematic way, and the doubling of the sculptures, the lion and those two sculptures there at the edge of the pool, along with the trees themselves. The second monographic focus is on Auguste Rodin. Rodin never took pictures of his own sculpture, but he was deeply invested in the photographs that were taken of his work, and he very carefully directed every shot. So Rodin himself a kind of photography buff. He was one of the first people to subscribe to Edward Muybridge's Animal Locomotion, so it was first released as sort of a serial, right? So you could sign up for it as a subscription, and then every time Muybridge would put out another issue, you would get it. And he had a personal library of 7,000 prints himself. So despite his personal interest in photography, which seems quite extensive, Rodin had doubts about whether photography could be as emotive and moving as other forms of art. But he did realize that photography could be a great way for him to publicize his work. So beginning in the 1880s, he enlisted professional photographers to take pictures of his sculptures, all the while overseeing their sessions and even reviewing and editing the photographs. So you can see that he has made notations on their proof prints, he's told them where to crop, he's told them where to do something differently, how to frame something differently, and he also reserved the right to destroy any plates he liked. And on the flip side, he often signed the prints or etched sign the prints in the mounts, or etch the glass plates of those images that he did really like. So he took authorship, even though he didn't take the pictures himself. By the 1890s, Rodin's opinion of photography had changed again. He began exhibiting photographs of his sculptures alongside the bronzes themselves, realizing that photography was a cost-effective way for him to reproduce and exhibit more works than can fit in a space. So in one show, I think they said that he exhibited, you know, like upwards of 100 photographs next to his sculptures. By 1908, when the young... these are the clenched hands. So you can see that he's really staging this. It's not just to show his sculpture anymore. And these were studies for the Burghers of Calais. By 1908, when the young photographer Edward Steichen visited Rodin at his home outside Paris, Rodin was a convert. He was saying that through his photographs, Steichen would make the world understand his Balzac. So this photograph is part of a temporal series that Steichen took of Balzac, as it was placed by Rodin on a platform outside of his home. So Steichen wanted to take a photograph of the sculpture, but since it was plastered, it had this unappealing, chalky look when he was taking the images. So Rodin said, well, why don't you photograph it at night? So he stayed up all night and took multiple exposures, and then printed three. Well, he printed more than three, but these three were considered by Steichen to be the definitive group. This one at 4 a.m., 11 p.m., and actually Steichen did this arrangement. It's non-chronological. It doesn't follow the timestamp, but this is how he imagined it on the wall. 11 p.m. and midnight. So moving on to Constantin Brancusi. Brancusi's photographs were sort of the starting point of the show for Roxana Marcotte, who's the curator of the exhibition. She wrote her dissertation on Brancusi and always has said that, not on the photographs, actually. And she said that she always understood the sculpture through the photographs the best. So you see, unlike Rodin, Brancusi took photographs of his own work exclusively. He was friends with Man Ray, he was friends with Moholy-Nagy, he was friends with a slew of professional artists, photographers at the time, but he never allowed anyone else to take pictures of his work. He reserved that right for himself. And here you see one example of one kind of photograph that Brancusi took, and they're called the radiating photographs, because he calculated very carefully, so the angle of incidence of the light hitting the sculpture to sort of completely explode the form. So this is something that is, if you haven't seen the photographs of Brancusi before, is very antithetical to what you would think of when you think of his sculpture. He's known as a sculptor of pure form, of perfect platinist form. And he does something completely different in his photographs, which is he destroys that. And I don't know, you see here, you can barely tell the way that he's done it, but this is a little vase with some plants sticking with some flowers sticking out of it. And here is polished brown newborn too, which you can barely even make out anymore. And here is Bird in Space, where he's draped this tarp in the back and created these shadows and these patterns of light that really fight that form that we all know, that soaring thin form. And another kind of photograph that Brancusi took was the group mobile image. So what was also really important to him was not just the one form that people are all so obsessed with, and it's very alluring with Brancusi, but he wanted to have the sculptures interact in a space. So he would put pedestals, sculptures, and all different arrangements within his studio space and take an image and have that be another autonomous work of art, a different way to see his sculpture. Oh, and just to go back here, his interest in the studio is quite evident, and also when he left his entire holdings to his estate to the French government, he stipulated that they had to build an exact replica of his studio, which is what you see outside of Pompidou now. This is a photograph of newborn two, polished bronze, with his, with playing with a lot of, you know, sort of visual puns here. We have a loop. It's reflected within the polished bronze, placed within the studio, also reflecting the studio. And this is a later photograph by Man Ray that's sort of just to place Brancusi within the context of the kind of modern photography that was happening at the time, even beyond just the way he treated his works. Okay. So the last monographic section is Marcel Duchamp. And Duchamp was the inspiration behind the title of the exhibition, The Regional Copy. So Duchamp is the master of confusing the original and the copy to truly groundbreaking effect. This is MoMA's copy of the Box in a Valise, which was, Duchamp made 20 of these first edition boxes in the leather case with the strap. And it was basically his self-mounted retrospective in a box. So he took all of his works. I mean, each of these 20 boxes is slightly different, and put them into this box in different formations. Some of these images are completely missing in other boxes. Some of them are just juxtaposed differently. But here you're seeing how he's really playing with the idea, as he always did, of the original and the copy. So all of these are copies of his work, but he's, in this case, in these 20 cases, has put in an original work. There's a piece of celluloid here that he actually made, fashioned, and put into the box. And then he also went back and hand-colored some of these collotype reproductions of his work. The reproductions of ready-mades then become an original work again. So here you see on the right Marcel Duchamp's Unhappy Ready-Made of 1940, which is what's made for the box and is included in the box. And on the left, Unhappy Ready-Made 1920, a photograph taken by his sister. So this is one of his ready-mades, which was really just a set of instructions. So Suzanne Duchamp, his sister, and his friend Jean Croty were getting married, and this was a wedding present because he couldn't make it to the ceremony. He was in Buenos Aires at the time. But he sent his sister the set of instructions that said, take this geometry book and hang it outside your balcony and let the wind and the rain and anything happen to it, the sun be down on it, anything to just happen naturally. And that will be your unhappy ready-made. And so Suzanne Duchamp did that, and you'll see that the rain has warped the pages, the sun has faded all the text. And she took this picture in 1920 and sent it to Duchamp. And in 1940, he altered the picture and printed it again. So he's put back diagrams and text. So the next section focuses on cultural and political monuments. Allowing the shared identity of photographs and monuments as relics and souvenirs of the past and also testaments to loss play against each other. So it's these photographs that are already sort of testaments to loss, right? Sort of these leftover relics of something that was, of monuments, whose job is then to memorialize something that has passed. So this is an image by Sybil Bergman, who spent 11 years documenting the construction of a monument to Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels in Berlin. The sculpture was finally erected in 1986, and 3 years later, the Berlin Wall fell. This image captures this poignant moment where the figure of Engels is being lifted into place, ready to be dropped into place, but a few short years later, the meaning of the monument and the significance of the photograph changes dramatically. Because now, I think most of the time when people see this image, they think of it as something being dismantled post the fall of the wall, when not only is it being put into place at this late date, but it's also still there in Berlin after some arguments. Berlin decided to keep it there. And now it's a popular tourist attraction. So the other figure in this sculpture, if you've seen in this monument, is a seated Marx. And so people will often now get on Marx's lap and then we'll take this nice souvenir picture back home. This is a picture from Robert Frank's The Americans, which was published in 1958. So part of this this section of cultural and political icons then deals with how the monument has been treated often in photo books. So the Americans is one, and then we'll see Freelander's American Monument is another, and then Goldblatt's book is another. But this is the only picture from Robert Frank's The Americans that feature sculpture, and out of 83 photographs that were carefully selected from over 800 rolls of film that Frank took while he was traveling from 55 to 56 across the country on his Guggenheim Fellowship. So you see here that it's St. Francis in silhouette, preaching to, or maybe blessing, a bleak Los Angeles vista and gas station there across from him. This is Lee Freelander's photograph of Father Duffy, and it's from The American Monument, which was published in 1976. Father Duffy was a military chaplain and priest in the Times Square area, and he was also a war hero. So he went out, and after he fought in World War I, he came back to serve as a pastor at Holy Cross Church on 42nd Street. But here you see him engulfed in the cacophony of signage in Times Square. So not only is Freelander here making a really visually rich and clever image, and all these intersecting lines and the mirroring of that vertical thrust of the sculpture, but it also might leave you questioning the ways in which monuments succeed and fail in their purpose, which is what a lot of these pictures do after that moment, what the monuments mean, and then also when you're taking a picture of it in a different context, it again changes it. So instead of being something that's truly like monuments, especially in the amongst any sculpture, they're sort of the things that are the most, they have the most heft, the most permanence. And here, trying to really, through these pictures, you're seeing immutability instead of that permanence. This is David Goldblatt, who's a South African artist. This work is from his book, South Africa, The Structure of Things Then, which is a visual investigation of the monuments and buildings of South Africa and the political and cultural conditions of the country that sort of shaped these monuments, these structures. So this is actually about the colonial history of South Africa. It's a 3-meter-high concrete globe that commemorates Carl Landman, who was a farmer that participated in the Great Trek, which is a migration in the 1830s and 40s of South Africans, native South Africans, to escape British colonial rule. And in a later book, Goldblatt then took a color picture of the same sculpture from the opposite side. So moving on to the Studio Without Walls, Sculpture in the Expanded Field, which is a section that deals with land art and the tradition of moving out of the studio space and into the world to take these images. This is a work by Cyprian Gaillard in the forefront here. This is a work called Geographical Analogies that he worked on from 06 to 09. The entire work is comprised of 100 boxes and were presented like this, except with 50 boxes on each side. And each box contains 9 Polaroids. You can see the details here that the artist has taken around the world of architecture, sculpture, landscapes in various degrees of order and disorder or ruin. So he presents each Polaroid tipped on one corner and balanced there. So actually the works will shift, but he shifts them back into place each time he installs the work. And he arranges them which is important for him, in a non-hierarchical grid. So the center image isn't the most important image. It's just the image that's in the center. Gaillard is, if you look back here, the Gaillard is installed across from the Smithson purposefully, because Cyprian Gaillard sees Smithson as an artist he has a natural affinity with. He's a land art pioneer, and this is the tradition that Gaillard is working firmly in, as you can see. And he also shares Smithson's interest in the idea of entropy. So entropy is thermodynamic property, and it's an expression of the amount of randomness or disorder in a system. And it also states that closed systems always tend to move towards a state of greater entropy, and this can't be reversed. So in the case of Gaillard's Polaroids, He chose Polaroids for a reason. They're immediate, which he likes, but also they're very fugitive, the color. So they're hard to conserve. If you show them the way he's been showing them, they'll fade, and he's looking forward to that, actually. The color's bleaching out and fading away. So this is one of the sources of that work. While traveling in Mexico, Smithson made a series of photographs of 12-inch square mirrors that he installed in various sites as he traveled. He later published these photographs in an essay in Art Forum called Incidents of Mirror Travel in the Yucatan. That was in 1969. So the mirrors serve to fracture and displace the landscape that they're set in, and challenges your attempts to either penetrate or inhabit the space. It multiplies it, but it also really breaks it up. So in the tradition of land art, the work exists only now as photographs, and in this case was staged for the camera, and the format of the camera, that square format mirroring the squares that he's using, was really important for the visual concept of the work. So going from Smithson's to the next section, Daguerre's Soup, What is Sculpture? So here already you're starting to see sculpture that's only sculptural because it's captured by the camera. And this is the kind of tradition that informs this section of the show, which starts with Brassai and Dalí's involuntary sculptures made for Minotaur. So Dalí provided the captions, and Brassai took these photographs of just bits and scraps of discarded material. This is a Paris bus ticket that's been rolled up. This is a blob of toothpaste. This is a piece of bread, and the way they're isolated and shot in close-up sort of takes on the sculptural form. And they really had no importance before the work. This was for the photographs. Working in the same tradition as Polish artist Alina Sapochniko, who took photographs of chewing gum sculptures that she made. The sculptures don't exist anymore. And then we have Rachel Harrison's Voyage of the Beagle, 41 of the 57 works that make up the whole piece, installed as a sculptural frieze, which wasn't initially intended, but it works really well in the context of this show. Voyage of the Beagle, of course, she's referencing Darwin's Voyage of the Beagle, and where she took a trip to Corsica, which was the starting off point, and she found these ancient sculptures, these menhirs, these stone markers that people there don't even know what they're for. They can only guess. But she started with that and began sort of just observing, like Darwin was observing all that time, taking pictures, not really trying to make any sort of connection just then. And then later she came back and she continued to take pictures in New York and started creating a typology of sculpture, basically. So at this point, we're really asking, what is the shape that sculpture can take? It can take the shape of a work of land art. It can be some scrap of material that, because the artist has isolated it and taken a picture of it in close-up as an autonomous object, becomes something of a sculpture. Or it can be the physical sculpture that we saw earlier on in the show. Moving on to the penultimate section of the exhibition is the Pygmalion Complex. Animate and inanimate figures. And this refers to the classical myth, best known to us through Ovid, in which the sculptor Pygmalion falls in love with the sculpture of a woman he has carved out of ivory. So he makes offerings to the goddess Venus and asks her to bring the sculpture to life, which she ultimately does. Happy ending, they get married and have a child. But the photographs in this section all deal with an uncanny juxtaposition, or otherwise conflation, of the living body and the sculptural object. This is Man Ray's Violon d'Angra, which shows Alice Prin, better known as Kiki of Montparnasse, sort of styled as an Angra-esque bather, but her torso, her back turned towards you, armless, and her torso turned into a violin. And what it plays on is the title, Violon d'Angra, is a French idiom that translates into hobby, basically. So so this is like a hobby art would be to Man Ray, or violin to musician. But of course, it's not just a beautifully executed visual pun we're presented with here. The image creates an uneasy tension between the admiration of a woman's body and the objectification of it. We have here a playful image of Man Ray, of Picabia imitating Rodin's Balzac. So I just put that in there to come full circle. This is Gillian Waring, self-portrait at 17 years old from her series album. And in these pictures, she's taking pictures from her family album and then restaging them wearing a mask. So this is her, 40 or so years old, playing herself at 17. And the only place you can really see the mask is the eyes here. You see they're sort of double sockets. But she works with people from Madame Tussauds, and they form these, you know, really stunningly realistic masks for her. And you can see it sort of more in these other pictures from the series, where this is her acting as herself at 3 years old. And these are all larger than life size. And when you walk up to it, they're actually bigger than you. And then as her grandfather. And then we finally get to the final section of the exhibition, which comes to where you no longer need a sculptural element in the picture at all. The performing body is sculptural, becomes a sculptural object for the performance artists. See some works by Valley Export, Charles Ray, Dennis Oppenheim. This is a Eve Klein photograph, the famous photograph Leap into the Void, where he staged this action. And of course, you know, when you magnify this image, you can see that there is a seam here where the photographer Harry Shunk has collaged one scene where here there was originally a tarpaulin that he jumped onto. And I mean, it's one of these silly stories, but right across the street, he chose this site because right across the street there was apparently a judo center where he knew he could find sort of these athletes to help catch him. And then he took this picture and sewed it together, and then this publication was put out for one day, the Journal of One Day, sort of handed out to people in the streets that who were then left to contemplate what happened, what actually happened. And this is a work by the Dutch artist Bas Jan Arder, and this is set up on a brick road leading up to a lighthouse in West Capelle, Holland, where this was a really popular, the lighthouse itself was a really popular subject for the early paintings of Mondrian. And this is Adder's sort of comical, absurdist riff on the legacy of de Stijl and its utopian ideas of simplicity and harmony, reduction of gesture into vertical and horizontal line and primary color. And Adder's failure to achieve the de Stijl ideal, or perhaps just the impossible task of even responding to this overwhelming history of his city, of de Stijl, of Mondrian, is evidence in the artist's pose, which is, you know, as if he had just fallen flat on his face. But in each picture, you see he's adding one more element that completes the de Stijl project. This is Anna Mendieta's Tree of Life from her Silhouette series. I'm running a little short on time, so I'm going to finish up with Eleanor Anton, and then we can maybe have a couple of questions if there are any. This is Eleanor Anton's The Last 7 Days, which is a smaller excerpt from the 1972 piece Carving, a Traditional Sculpture. A series of 148 photographs that document the artist's diet over 37 days to lose 10 pounds. So each day is documented by 4 pictures, her from the front, from the back, from the side, from the side. The pictures and arrangements are Muybridge-like, which is a relationship that she herself acknowledges. And I actually just went to a panel discussion the other night with Eleanor Anton, so we got a little inside scoop on the picture, which is on the project, which is that in 72, the Whitney had called her and asked her to make a piece for their, at that point, the biennials were separated by medium. So it was the 1972 Whitney Museum Biennial of American Sculpture. They called her, they got some ideas back from her, she described this work, and they said, you know what, we really wanted more of a traditional sculpture. Sorry. So she couldn't show it there, but she did end up showing it the same year elsewhere. But this was originally her idea for a sculpture biennial, which I think is very... So that's it. If you guys have any questions?
What about the eagle? Like, what was the reason behind the installation?
on the top. Well, actually, it came as the very, I guess the ultimate reason was practical. Because the galleries up on the sixth floor for photographs have really high ceilings, very, very tall walls. And so photographs tend to get a little lost, but the way the show was installed, it was so full. We have over 300 works, and so that problem sort of became minimalized, and the opposite problem occurred, where we didn't know where to put it, and it made the most sense in that section. It truly belonged to that section, but the whole piece is 57 works, and Rachel Harrison actually really likes it to be shown in its entirety whenever possible. But we just didn't have the space for that, so we showed 41 out of 57, but the only place we could put it was at the top. And after that, like right after that, Roxana, of course, saw the relationship between a sculptural frieze and that work, but it wasn't the artist's intention, and it sort of came out of a practical necessity. Yeah.
When Quincy did the photography, did he have the intent of selling them, or was it something for his own purpose?
You know, that's a good question, because I don't know what he... I haven't read about him selling anything, but I do know that the Pompidou has so much. They have everything, basically. So I think he just kept them in an archive. They have multiple prints of every work, and then photographs of every work. It's a really, really extensive collection. So I doubt that he ever, if he maybe gave them away as gifts to artist friends, maybe, but I don't think he sold them at the time. Do you have a question? Oh, okay.
How does an artist determine how many prints they're
going to make? Oh, well, that's personal for every artist. Some artists are very, I would say the better-known artists who are represented by big galleries tend to then limit their editions, keeping them a little bit smaller. And especially at the scale that some of the contemporary photographs are being made in now, it's sort of just cost prohibitive and cumbersome to be making a lot of prints, so they keep them small. But, you know, I mean, depends. And if you're looking at somebody like Cartier-Bresson, who took photographs as a photojournalist, there are tons of copy prints and proof prints, and those aren't considered then to be, you know, maybe something that a museum would collect. But it's different in every situation. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I wanted to know, in your personal studies for this exhibition,
mm-hmm.
what's your point of view with the Malraux hypothesis?
With the Malraux?
Yeah. So while studying, if you just discovered some things in the links between sculpture and photography, and if it's a real way to know better the work and to discover new things?
Yeah, I think so. I think because sculpture especially has that sort of, I mean, they're additioned as well, but they're so, like, one form in one place. If you're not there to see it, you don't have the experience of it. And so pictures and the way that you can kind of just mix in without thinking about, you know, time or place that they were made, it just inevitably will bring up different ideas, right? So the first section of the show is like that, where it's totally non-chronological. Barbara Kruger is next to daguerreotypes or next to Kertész prints, and something has to come out of that, right? I mean, it's just, it really does open up the way in which you see sculpture then, when you see all of these different ways that it's been treated. And the similarity is obvious from, you know, the very simple point that there are all sculptures in it too. And then, but then you start to see all these different relationships form, even between rooms in the show. I think it is something that's really, that photography has given to art in a more general sense.
Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
How is digital effective taking of photographs? I mean, a Lee Freelander still uses a regular camera.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even have a digital camera. I still use a regular camera.
We had sort of like an artist walkthrough with photography department and our council members about that, and it was interesting. Every photographer has a different feel. I mean, Lee will probably always use analog photography, but then somebody like Paul Graham, who is also very much in that sort of tradition of like street photography, of proper, like well-made, beautiful photographs, he uses digital and he doesn't see a problem with it at all. So it's, yeah, it is an interesting question. Some people really have this nostalgia for prints, curators, artists, students, but...
As a private person today, it's so difficult to get regular 35mm film processed. I mean, most places don't do it anymore.
Yeah, no, it's a natural, I think it's a natural evolution of photography. It started out as a process that was more democratic than others, right? There was no academies. People could buy these things, were commercially available, and you could go out and take these pictures. And now it's just changing with the times. It's becoming more and more what it was always meant to be, I think, something that everybody can do.
You put that Brancusi's photographs and Marcel Duchamp's miniature in a box,
mm-hmm.
a piece of box, in one room.
Yes.
Why? What's the concept or idea?
Well, that was two things, I guess. It was against space, because there really would be unwieldy to sort of break this gallery space up into 10 discrete rooms. You would kind of feel trapped in each room. And then Duchamp and Man Ray were, you know, peers. So that sort of just felt like a natural connection, in a way.
What's the period of that Brancusi's photographs?
Brancusi was taking photographs throughout the 20s and into the 40s.
That means Marcel Duchamp's copy.
Our box was dated 1943. Yeah.
No influence between the two?
Direct influence? I don't know. But that's not, I mean, we weren't trying to state like a direct influence, but it was kind of a combination of them being like linked chronologically and also in sort of sensibility, and then in modern sensibility, and then also the space dictated it a bit.
Yeah. Do you know that Marcel Duchamp was one time selling Brancusi's pieces?
Oh, he was a dealer?
Yes.
I think that Roxana was telling us about the... sort of connection. Yeah, they had, there was a show at Francis Naumann sort of about the, it wasn't at all to do with Duchamp, but it was sort of, the title was taken from like a letter, I think, that Duchamp had written to Brancusi. They had, yeah, they did have correspondence, but in terms of making like a connection between those two bodies of work, it wasn't really like that. Do you have time for one more?
One more. The photography and the photography you show seem to capture photos that were actual photos rather than framed photos where they put one photo on top of another.
Right.
And I was thinking of the St. Francis picture with the gas station in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a real photo?
That was just a photo captured at that right light and from behind, so the sun sort of completely turned that sculpture into a silhouette. That was, yeah.
So
Frank didn't manipulate that photo.
So did most of these photographers only work on real photos, so to speak?
Most, but not all. I mean, even in the 20s, people were doing Dada collages, and those were very... much toyed with, so constructed, not at all like a straight photograph.